You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 110. And with me tonight, I have George Karyanis and Kelly Taylor. And George is the executive director of Energize America. Welcome.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you. Great to be here.
And I'm glad you could join us. We had a little bit of technical difficulties, but we're all set now. Okay. So, George, why don't you tell the listeners of Atomic Show what Energize America is all about?
Certainly. And Energize America is really three things, if you look at it, or it's got three main facets to it. It is a specific set of policy proposals to achieve U.S. energy independence and reduce greenhouse gases a minimum of 50% by 2020. It is 20 specific acts, 19 specific proposals, and then a funding act. Very strategic, very comprehensive in its scope. It addresses transportation, residential, commercial, industrial consumption, generation and transmission, all fuel sources. It is a comprehensive proposal, concrete in terms of depth, to achieve U.S. energy independence and dramatically reduce greenhouse gases by 2020. That was put together in 2005-2006. We unveiled it with New Mexico Governor, former Secretary of Energy Bill Richardson at the yearly COES convention. In 2006, we had, you will recall, a Republican president, Republican-controlled Congress, and Governor Richardson said, not going to happen this year at the federal level, focus at the state level, and when there's a Democratic-controlled Congress, then, you know, perhaps strategic energy legislation is more likely. Now, it came together, so it's a 20-point plan for U.S. energy independence. Think of it as a snapshot circa 2006. And there's some great stuff in there. Some of it's dated. Some of it needs to be refreshed. But what the real secret sauce to Energize America, it is, I believe, the very first open source public policy development process that has ever really been attempted. Bill McKibben, a noted environmentalist and activist, said it was like Wikipedia with a purpose. So what was so amazing about Energize America, that 20-point plan was put together by volunteers using blogs and wikis. And so every comment, every proposal, every step of the way is fully transparent and open to review and comment. So the plan itself came together over 9 months, five formal versions, and over 50,000 comments was distilled into this 20-point plan. So it's a 20-point plan. It's a very innovative process that proved to me beyond the shadow of a doubt that the public can effectively craft legislation. There were no lobbyists drafting these proposals. And the third thing it is a specific snapshot in 2008 aiming at a very modest 5-point plan for some freshmen congressmen who it's a much more much less ambitious than boiling the ocean. It's five things such as the Energy Smart Communities Act, some green schools, some plug-in hybrid electric buses. So it's about a $3 billion, it's morphed into about a $3 billion set of 5 points that a band of incoming freshmen can rally behind and say, here's what we want in the energy plan. So it's many things. The 20-point plan, think of as a photograph. The transparent process that developed it is the secret sauce that should be carried forward in a number of areas, healthcare, campaign finance reform. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever participated in my life.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. One question I have is, how are you sure that there were no lobbyists involved?
Good point.
I like that.
Well, let me rephrase that and say that to the degree that any lobbyists were involved, to those that are not familiar with the Daily Kos blog system, and this took place on the Daily Kos simply because that's where a series of energy conversations dynamically sprung up, Q105, Q205, a handful of front pagers and very popular bloggers, experienced in a range of energy issues. It just snowballed, and it collectively we all said, "Gee, why don't we put this together as a plan? No one's got a plan. Let's put together a plan." So the Daily Kos blog allows commenters, diarists, and anyone who comments to rate which comments are effective, are well written. So it doesn't matter, you know, on the internet, no one can see you, no one knows. You have to stand by how well you articulate your point. And people who do that well are recommended. Those comments rise to the surface in terms of numbers of recommendations, things like that. And the people who write the diaries that get all of these comments, those diaries, if they're popular, get recommended and they stay up for quite a while. The Daily Kos at that time had about a million unique visitors, I think, a day. So it was getting some very heavy reading and a lot of commenting. And to your question, how could we tell who was or was not a lobbyist? People who consistently came back with just one line of reasoning, you know, their logic wore thin after a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a collective process. And so if there was a lobbyist from coal or nuclear or wind, didn't matter, their credentials were far less important than the merit of their comments. And so if they were a lobbyist, that was actually okay as long as they brought value to the conversation. But what the collective group did not really allow for was dominance by any one individual, any one train of thought, anything like that.
Yeah, it's a great kind of ability on the internet to debate, to share thoughts, and to have real solid, open peer review processes.
I'm leery of using that phrase peer review because to academicians it means something very specific. But what I would say is that it was peer rated. I mean, I agree with you that it was peer reviewed, but yeah, I don't want that phrase to come under attack by, you know, the Journal of Intense Analytical Issues. You know, they take that stuff very seriously. We're just average Joes. Most people had a degree, but go ahead, Kelly.
I'm familiar with the wiki process and how that produces things on the web and very fascinated with the quality of output that you can get from that. But I'm not real familiar with the Daily Kos. Can you tell me maybe what Kos stands for and a little bit more about that particular?
Good job. Yes, good question. The Daily Kos is a political blog. It's a progressive political blog started by Marcos Moulitsis. And I think it started in 2004. MyDD, it's a spinoff of that, or it just goes back to the roots of blogging. and it's a progressive political blog. Marcos is very focused on electing progressive Democrats. It's not, and that's why I say Energize America is three things, and the next evolution of Energize America will not exist solely within Daily Kos. It was a great place for the genesis of it, but it now Energize America and energy independence is much greater, much bigger than any strain of political influence. Energize America needs to include the Daily Kos, needs to include Red State, needs to include the Sierra Club. It needs to include a broad spectrum of beliefs and opinions. So the
I
Daily
agree.
Kos, But at the time, in 05, there were no – I was looking around for strategic energy conversations, none to be had. And again, it had that rating system that really separated the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, I find it intriguing that the advice you were given was to wait for Democratic control, because the issue is really broader than any one political party. It's something
well, but he also – but he also – Governor Richardson also said, go work in the states. You know, you got to go work with the governors where, you know, because federal policy, it's not going to happen in this administration is what he said.
Yeah, I wasn't finding fault with the advice you were given. It just seems to me to be a much bigger issue that seems kind of a parochial response for something that we should all be concerned about and involved in.
In 2006, 9 out of 10 people in this country were still asleep at the wheel.
Well, Kelly and I have not been asleep at the wheel. We've been working on energy issues for at least the last 30 years now.
Please. I mean, and I certainly did not mean to imply you guys, but when you look at 330 million Americans, I'd say that less than 3.3 million Americans are focused real hard on energy independence, especially when you go back to 2006. You know, they start paying $4 or $5 a gallon of gas. They start getting, you know, they start waking up. You know, I mean, it's not that energy wasn't important, but in 2006, I certainly, if you polled the electorate, energy independence was not a burning issue.
Well, yeah, when you talk about energy independence,
to sell this message for a long time.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, it's a small number of people ringing that bell.
Yeah, when you talk about energy independence, do you envision a time when America isolates itself from the world and stops buying oil and natural gas from abroad?
Okay, so that's a two-part question. That the first part, I would say that isolationism is absolutely unnecessary. In fact, we are inextricably linked. But does energy independence, or could energy independence mean the end of fossil fuels? Certainly. Could it mean the end of imported oil? Absolutely. But could it mean the creation of high-value exportable products, wind and solar, geothermal systems, software systems? Absolutely. So it doesn't mean we retreat. It just means we change the dynamics of the energy equation.
Now, this is bringing up part of the reason I wanted to have an open discussion with you is it's pretty evident from reading the plan and from speaking to you that the people who have come up with Energize America put nuclear power towards the bottom of the list of options. And, of course, Kelly and I are very openly nuclear professionals who believe very strongly that the technology that we've been working in for the last 20 to 30 years is not at the bottom of the list of alternatives to fossil fuels.
So the role of nuclear within Energize America, given the genesis of the plan on a progressive political blog, nuclear was the most contentious issue. Among all of it, other than how do we pay for it, that resulted in endless debate. But the nuclear issue was a very difficult one to navigate, and what we ultimately did recommended was let's fast track one or two plants. Let's have them open in record time. Let's have the nuclear power industry select which one or two plants, which next gen technologies, which locations. I would say that many of us were influenced by Amory Lovins and other folks who think that nuclear can be a part of the mix, but it's not where they would lead. Now, everyone has a personal opinion. Energize America is nothing but a collection of individuals. And in fact, when I talk about Energize America, the core team was about six people. We had about three dozen team leads, and then it was a very flat organization. So yes, the six core team members did have to make decisions on how do we incorporate all of these edits. I served as editor of the plan. Mm-hmm. It wasn't this, there had to be minimum hierarchy so that decisions could be made. But the role of nuclear was debated widely. We decided to include it. What is relevant now is that both presidential candidates are in favor of nuclear power, so it's not what we think per se. Now we need to, for the next version of Energize America, it needs to reflect the reality. We're 2 years into it. Now we know a lot more in terms of how viable or not clean coal is, things like that. Personally speaking, and I shared this with you in an email, Rod, I would take 100% nuclear. I didn't say this, but I would take 100% nuclear and no coal if I had a choice. Coal is a gift from the devil in some ways.
Well, of course, coal has lighted an awful lot of homes and provided a lot of
Did trees and so did whale oil, and we hunted them to extinction.
Well,
near extinction.
Yeah, but we would never have gotten to where we are today as a society without having the fossil fuels that we've built our society upon. Now,
there is no disagreement with that.
There are people who believe that they would like to go back to an age where weather-dependent power is what we have learned to live on, but I believe that if we did that, we'd have a world population of about 500,000 people, or maybe 500,000,000. But
that's a very small fragment of people, if you want to take that phrase, weather-dependent power. That's a very small fraction of people who view it like that. I mean, the issue with coal is greenhouse gas emissions. It is mountaintop removal and greenhouse gas emissions. Energize America views both of those as something we must stop mountaintop removal, and we must dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Right. We need to get back within the natural ability of plants and algae to consume the CO2 that is produced.
Yes,
so
yes. And when you look at energy demand increase and population demand increase, China and the U.S. burning coal fast as they can, we are highly concerned about cumulative greenhouse gas emissions without sane policies in place.
Right. So let me go back to my characterization, and I believe it's an accurate one from a technical point of view, that the wind, solar, and biofuels are all weather-dependent power sources.
Geothermal
cannot be divorced.
Geothermal is not. And when you overlay, if you zoom out, if you look at wind and solar at a macro level, they are far less weather-dependent than not. The wind is always blowing somewhere, and the wind is usually blowing at night. So I mean, it in the aggregate, and I'm not recommending that we go to 100% renewables. If we could get there, that would be great. But right now our renewable mix, even if you include hydro, what are we, around 5 or 6, 9 maybe?
including hydro, you're about, well, if you include hydro and then, of course, what the DOE counts as alternatives, which includes waste-to-energy plants and wood pulp consumption, you're at about 7 or 8.
And most now, of that's, most of that is TVA.
Right. And if you just, well, it's TVA and Northwest Power.
It's nothing.
Well, and if you look at wind and solar together, after 30 years worth of construction, they're less than 1% of electricity demand, which is about, what, 1/3 of 1% of energy demand.
But I posit that the reason for that is a lack of coherent federal policy, not a lack of technology or desire. You can, if you just track the production tax credit, and when they yank it, and when they implement it, and when they take it away, it, you know, the this country has not had a strategic energy policy ever, and so it may be silly to even think we can have one, but we have never had a strategic policy, from my opinion.
Right, and that goes back to Kelly's point about the absolute need to come to a bipartisan solution.
Absolutely.
Maybe a multipartisan solution, because something that's going to be, you know, implemented by 2020, it'd be a pretty optimistic progressive who believes that there is going to be no changes in party leadership between now and 2020, whether it be in the House or the Senate or the Oval Office.
Oh, even more important, this has to be in our genetic coding as a country.
Right.
This is way bigger than frivolous politicians who are voted in and out.
We need strong leadership from the people that set the regulations. We tell them this is what we're sending you there for. This is the kind of leadership and the hard decisions that need to be made to set a policy that doesn't just get us through your 2 years of your term or 6 years of your term or,
right,
you know, years if you want to get reelected, set a policy that we can expect and chart our course by for the next 30 years.
And that's where the role of the internet and open source public policy development really can come into play, because now the citizens are much more aware of the cost of energy or energy technologies. I'd still say that we've got a long way to go, but we have to demand it. And to use the moonshot, it works in many ways, and Rod, you're right, it doesn't work in several. But where it does work as an analogy, strong federal leadership, deep private buy-in. You know, those Americans in the 60s, they understood the vision, they bought into that, they shared. Same thing in World War II, shared sacrifice. Everybody knew there was a role to play, and everybody played a role. It's going to take that same collective effort to get there, starting with strong federal leadership, but it's got to get into our genetic coding. It's got to be our children. When they graduate, they have to have a fundamentally different perspective of energy consumption, energy-efficient product design, all sorts of things. And that doesn't mean old people shiver to death in the dark. That is such I don't want to say bullshit, because that would be inappropriate. But, you know, those kind of comments and you know, much coal lobbying, I'll be honest, I think a lot of the coal lobbying, there a lot has been a lot of messages have really derailed a strategic energy discussion.
Well, it's hard to get rid of the economic aspects of energy when it is the world's largest single industry in terms of revenue.
Energy is life.
Well, exactly. And it's going to be extremely difficult to implement a policy that really does reduce the revenue of large and powerful corporations who enjoy that revenue.
For thousands of years, man has looked at the moon, and in 10 years, we went from talking about it to circling it to landing on it and coming home safely.
Okay,
it is very hard. It is it is not impossible.
Okay,
as an American, I refuse to believe that.
Let's go back a little bit. The moonshot could only happen because the technology existed before we ever started. The German rocket program was part of what we built our moonshot program. It wasn't all of a sudden.
Couple decades.
It wasn't all of a sudden.
Yeah, it wasn't out of the blue.
Right.
But it was to say it was a stretch goal is an understatement.
True, but there was no economic opposition to going to the moon other than the fact that it cost a lot of money.
You're right. It didn't displace anything. It actually was a economic boon.
Right. When you're coming to a policy of energy implementation that potentially displaces one single company with only 3% market share, makes $330 billion a year in revenue selling oil and natural gas, we got a big obstacle to overcome. That's ExxonMobil. They're about 3 to 4% market share. Their revenue is $330 billion. That's twice as much revenue as the U.S. Navy uses.
Well, as I said, the entrenched players pose a challenge. They are also part of the solution, undoubtedly. But the technologies that we have, that we need, do exist in many ways, and where they don't exist, versions of them exist, and hopefully we'll see even things like photovoltaic, and geothermal and algae, biodiesel. I mean, we want to see orders of magnitude improvement in those, but I mean, it's not brand new science, it's just refinements of existing products.
When you talk about geothermal, can you help me understand a little bit about the geographic distribution of that power source?
Certainly. So when I say geothermal, traditionally you think of the Yellowstone and the geyser. You know, there are, if you're familiar with a heat pump with a ground loop. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, sure. Yeah,
okay,
geothermal.
Yes, you can. The concept is what Google has just invested $10 million in. They call it enhanced geothermal, and it's traditional geothermal is very selective to the southwest, and I think some parts in the northwest. It's not universal. It's certainly not all over the country. Enhanced geothermal is they go down, they crack the rock, and then they circulate the water through, or probably a glycol kind of mix. So enhanced geothermal takes the properties inherent in a much broader segment of the geography and makes geothermal energy much more possible, much more efficient, cost efficient.
Now, as far as I can understand that, it still requires the drilling.
Oh, sure.
It's very similar drilling to oil drilling.
That's a good thing.
However, except for the fact that every drilling rig that we have in the U.S. is already fully engaged for the next 5 years.
True, but it's a known process. So, right. Yes, I agree.
And when you pull up, when you actually impact a oil field and you bring that oil up through a pipe, the amount of energy coming up through the pipe is far greater than the amount of hot water you can bring up through a pipe.
It's also finite.
Right.
Finite.
And geothermal, when you put the...
It's infinite.
How deep do you have to go to be infinite?
I don't want to misspeak on that one, but enhanced geothermal is one of those orders of magnitude improvement. So still, I think you're still at 3,000 feet sounds familiar, but I don't quote me on that.
All right, and how many enhanced geothermal plants are operating in the U.S. today?
This is new technology. They're just coming online. Single digit.
Okay. So by 2020, how many do you think will be operating?
Let's say it's 20. It's 2009. Enhanced geothermal, if it had the appropriate policy framework and capital investment, which it is one of the hottest areas that I can tell, I think it would be possible to have several dozen online It's not going to replace coal. It's not going to, you know, I mean, but again, it's what's the end result? What's the best way to get there? And enhanced geothermal will certainly play a big, an important role. Remains to be seen how big a role.
Okay, so let's go over the a little bit of the plan between now and 2020. What is going to replace coal, for example?
Well,
that provides we burn about 1.2 billion tons of coal a year in the U.S.
Yeah, it's half our energy. It's half our electricity. What is going to if we look at Energize America, what is going to displace coal is renewables, aggressive, hyper-aggressive deployment of wind, solar, geothermal, biofuels, tidal, you know, that's tiny and takes a while, but yeah, all of the above. Efficiency, you know, it's Energize America as the plan, tried to do a couple of key things. One, it tried to electrify transportation to get us off petroleum, and then it tries to generate as much electricity as cleanly as possible so that we don't continue to blow up mountains and burn coal. We minimize that. So anything we can do to minimize coal. So, again, Energize America EA 2020 was a snapshot in 2006. What's salient today is what either Senator McCain or Senator Obama are going to drive in early early Q2, I believe, at the latest, we will see energy legislation, strategic energy legislation being voted on. That's just my personal opinion. I mean, they both have energy plans. It is going to be one of those top items in their 100-day agenda. And so the question is, in terms of Energize America, the next version, how can we best influence that, and we'll know in 3 weeks which plan, but they both have nuclear in them. They both have nuclear. So the hesitancy that was initially in Energize America, I would say that some of those concerns will always be there. I personally would like to see a resolution of the waste issue. Okay, is it Yucca Mountain? Is it not Yucca Mountain? I don't like the idea of building 100 new power plants without having an answer in advance as to what you're going to do with those, with the waste from those plants. Now, if there's a legitimate answer that, you know, that doesn't require Yucca Mountain, but the point is, let's put nuclear on a level playing field with renewables. If renewables need additional production tax credits, feed-in tariffs, I think that's an investment that is to the benefit of America, to the citizens. And nuclear is in the mix. Period. The question is, how do we educate the citizens about what that strategic plan should look like, and how do we minimize the concerns and fears about nuclear power? You know, there's a lot of misinformation on coal, on nuclear, on renewables, and at the end of the day, we thought of ourselves, Energize America thought of ourselves as lobbyists for the American people. We believe in renewable power, but, we still have to light our homes. We have to heat our homes. Right. And we have to do that today, and we have to do that in 10 years. So we tried to be very pragmatic and at the same time be very strategic in terms of let's set some very aggressive goals because no one else is doing that.
Right. One of the things that in the energy debate that frustrates me, having been a manufacturer for a while, is the focus on residential power. Since residential power is only about 18% of our electricity use.
I thought it was about a third. I thought commercial was a third, industrial was about a third, and residential and aggregate was a third.
Now, buildings are a third, but of the buildings, a fair amount of buildings is commercial power because that includes malls and office buildings and all that kind of stuff. Transportation is about a third, and industrial uses is about a third. But residential is only about 18%.
Of electric power?
Of electric power, yep.
So you're saying transportation, things like electric rail, because I don't think I didn't
no.
really.
Let's say that again. Residential buildings are 18% of electrical power. Of the electrical power portion, 33% is buildings. So, about half of the building power is residential power. The other half is commercial buildings.
Yes.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And then there's industrial uses, and then heating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, residential.
So your concern is that there's too much emphasis on the residential piece.
I mean, I am interested in American job opportunities, and one of the things that always seems to happen when you conserve electricity is you make the price so expensive that the manufacturers can't afford to run their steel plants or their automobile manufacturing facilities or their toy manufacturing or whatever it is, and all that stuff moves offshore.
Hold on. I want to make sure I followed that. So a reduction in demand of electricity causes the price to increase?
No. The price increase is what effectively reduces the demand.
Oh, I gotcha.
Like California's been touted as a great energy efficient state, but what happened to California was many actions that combined to continually increase the price of electricity and push manufacturing out of California.
So
California now, go ahead, Kelly.
The per capita energy consumption is the lowest in the country. But that's because they've moved so much of their economy out of the state to the rest of the country because they're heavy-duty manufacturing and the high electricity consumption businesses, if they had the ability to move, they did. Because they couldn't afford the electric.
I haven't seen anything that really laid the blame for that outsourcing of manufacturing jobs squarely at the feet of California's electricity prices. But clearly, the cost of electricity is one component that a manufacturer is going to look at. And I agree with you that we want to create jobs, and we certainly don't want to stimulate the outsourcing of jobs artificially.
Yeah, and of course, manufacturing energy dependence depends on exactly what product you're producing. If you're producing fertilizer, something like 40 to 60% of the cost of the product is the cost of the energy input.
Mm-hmm.
If you're producing steel or aluminum, it's maybe 35 to 50%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's considerable.
Yeah, so, I mean, energy is a huge portion of the input to those products. I mean, at one point there was a lot of aluminum production up in the Pacific Northwest because of the hydroelectric dams up there.
Mm-hmm.
And when California had its energy supply issues in the 2000 timeframe, most of those aluminum producers shut down completely because they could sell their power to California and make more money than they could running the aluminum factory.
Right, and I actually was living in San Diego from 2000 to 2005. I lived through those rolling blackouts. In fact, that was it was the lack of energy policy that caused me to take a sabbatical and start Energize America. But let's just say that the issues facing California in the early 2000s were criminal and avoidable.
Yeah.
That was just criminal.
Well, there was one supply issue that has gotten very little attention, and that is in August of 2000, I believe it was, August of 2000, there was a natural gas pipeline explosion.
Got rid of one third
of the supply,
yeah,
of natural gas to California, and that lasted for over a year.
Yeah.
Yep, and that was an El Paso pipeline near Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Yeah, that was a bad thing.
Yeah, killed 12 people.
But we're in agreement that we want good manufacturing jobs, that we want very cost effective electricity rates.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we are in complete agreement on that.
Yeah, and we also, like you said, we want to stop blowing up mountains. I'm a backpacker, and get very distressed when I see the scars in West Virginia.
If the average American, when they flip on a light, could simply imagine that the top of a mountain just blew off. I mean, it's like the crazy cousin that you never talk about or never bring out, you know. But West Virginia is being raped. And it's not just the destruction of the mountains, it's all that slurry.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is an ecological disaster. But you know, I'm in Philadelphia. I'm gonna leave my lights on. I'm in New Mexico. I don't feel, you know. I mean, consumers are so far removed. I mean, I guess if you really saw how your cow or hog were slaughtered, you'd be much less of a carnivore, probably. But it's the same thing in terms of electricity.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, because I think Kelly's probably got the same view as I do. We both have seen a lot of coal-fired power plants, and we see the trains coming in and filling up those hoppers every day, and the long lines of coal. We've also seen the one truck every 18 months to power a nuclear facility.
Okay, it was three trucks, but yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, I mean, on my desk, because I do care about visual images, on my desk I have this little fuel facsimile pellet that's about the size of my pinky that contains as much energy as a ton of coal.
Well, I believe there is a very important role for nuclear power. The next version of Energize America will have a more clearly defined nuclear component, because it will be broader in its input. And we would love for you to lead that, in fact. I mean, you guys are exactly the type of knowledgeable people who can say, here's what it should be.
Well, thank you. And we may take you up on that.
Yeah, it's a standing offer. It's a standing offer. Nuclear is in the next administration's policy. Doesn't matter who wins. It's either, Obama is a little softer. He's pro-nuclear, and he's taking money from Exelon. You know, I mean, it's not a surprise there. I don't know the extent of Obama's he hasn't been very specific.
I've never heard him called pro-nuclear before.
I'm sorry, you've never heard him called pro-nuclear?
I've never heard him called pro-nuclear before, but I agree that he mentions nuclear in his policy statements. I haven't seen anything concrete with a firm plan involved.
I haven't seen anything concrete either, but he, as an Illinois state senator, he did represent Exelon. He did allow he took Exelon money, and he ruled, he voted in their favor on some regulatory issues that essentially let them regulate themselves. I can't speak with clarity, but I remember when I read his role in that, I was somewhat dismayed, because it seemed like more of the same problem that we were looking at. You know, I don't want the fox guarding the hen house, period.
So who should regulate the wind industry?
I'm sorry?
Who should regulate the wind industry?
I have been thinking about something that I read on the oil drum. I think that it's a pretty radical concept, but I am increasingly in favor of nationalizing the grid and nationalizing baseload. I think there's an argument that could be made for that. You know, the grid is truly a bastard stepchild. Nobody owns it. The infrastructure upgrades are just like the wind and solar. The renewable production tax credit is a yo-yo. They take it, they pull it away. The incentives to upgrade the backbone just aren't there. And so it needs to have centralized control, centralized investment, personally. So who should regulate wind? If it's part of base load, if it's, you know, if it's a local municipality, they should be able to vote whether they want that energy source, whether it's a solar array, whether it's a wind farm.
Well, now that's interesting. I don't have a real strong opinion on that one way or another. I'm trying to figure out what the ramifications are if you nationalize the grid, but...
Just the backbone. Not the just the distribution, not the or just the transmission, not the distribution grid. So very high voltage stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you could cut that off at some kV, you know, but radical. It's a radical concept.
I'm trying to wrap my brain around it, but in the meantime, you're letting the municipalities choose what power station they have nearby.
That was just relative to if they wanted a wind farm. That's a power source. They could, you know, there could be, and I haven't read this anywhere other than, you know, should we nationalize? And I wouldn't want to nationalize the entire grid because I want that competition, but nobody is investing in their high voltage grid. It's two grids plus ERCOT. That's bullshit.
Oh, I don't know. There's a significant amount of investment that's always been made in the power grids in fairly large areas. There's the idea of transmitting power over hundreds of miles to thousands of miles becomes a losing game because you're losing so much power due to resistive heat losses.
Certainly with AC you are.
Well, with any kind of proven large-scale power distribution, you lose a lot of power, energy when you transmit over vast distances. There is some discussion of high-voltage DC.
There are some pilots out there that look quite promising.
Right, but we're talking about what can be done by 2020. You know, it's taken us... 75 years to build the grid we have. It takes a lot of investment over time, and it takes time to pay back that investment.
Oh, I agree, and I don't want to divert the conversation necessarily talking about nationalizing the grid or nationalizing baseload. But the point is, we have to look at it. There is no one probably in America who understands. Everything about the energy industry. It is so complex from generation to transmission to distribution to consumption across all the – I mean, it is bigger than any group of individuals. That's why it was so interesting and so informative to have thousands of people contributing to Energize America because they all brought a little perspective, and together it was like one of those mosaics of individual pictures that when you zoom back from it, it makes a different picture.
One of the things that I did want to bring up when you talk about that very democratic process, I read about the everyman concept, and you talk about the complexity of the grid, but the desire to kind of get away from the lobbyist point of view, and I fully understand that, but there are people, a fairly large number of professionals who have spent their life trying to master the very complex technology
yep.
that you're talking about. And sometimes, quite frankly, those people aren't the best communicators because engineers don't tend to be. Kelly's laughing because this is one of my themes.
So an extroverted engineer looks at the other guy's shoes. Is that what you're saying? I've worked with engineers all my life.
Yeah.
Many of the people who contributed to Energize America were industry professionals. They weren't just housewives who had a passion. I mean, they helped too, or they, you know,
hey,
I'm a messenger.
Wait, hold on. You can't downgrade housewives.
I certainly didn't mean. By that I meant people. I dug myself in a hole there. They weren't just innocent bystanders who happened upon this and had no expertise in the area, no domain expertise. Many of these people were deeply technical engineers in a variety of fields, from including nuclear, coal, wind, all over the place, energy efficiency, policy, and again, the beautiful housewife. I don't mean to and certainly not denigrating the housewife, but I mean people who were also messaging experts, PR experts. It was a virtual company, a complete virtual company focused on one thing, achieving a manageable energy independence plan. Now, one of your questions was, how does it compare to Pickens? How does it compare to Gore? How does it compare to all the other plans? And from what we have seen, none of them are as holistic or as broad in its scope. And even Energize America falls down at the grid. There was nothing in there about the grid other than federal net metering, which, God, we need federal net metering.
Thank you for clarifying that, George, because I wanted to cycle back around to that if you didn't cover it. I got the sense that you were talking ideas in space when you were talking about the grid, and I didn't want to misrepresent your position with any of our listeners. I was wondering if Energize America in their 20-point plan had anything to cover the grid, so I appreciate you clarifying the fact that no, because we're talking about ideas or what could be or what might be, that's not the same as saying that's what is in the Energize America plan.
Well, the components of the grid in Energize America were, again, federal net metering so that across the country there are uniform interconnect standards, not state-by-state patchwork of things that are slowing down innovation and investment. And then a lot of renewable stuff that would force the grid to be addressed, but for whatever reason, we didn't say, and this act is going to be about the grid. You know, it's kind of like the elephant that nobody really talks about, you know, because the grid is just, it's like your gas pipeline. It's, you know, just getting stuff from A to B. All the conversation is about generation and consumption, but not the transmission of it.
Yeah, well,
it's not sexy.
I'll give you a little bit of background. For me, transmission has been one of the things I've learned about for my whole life, because my father spent 35 years building transmission lines as an engineer. So I've always thought the transmission lines were pretty sexy. He actually would take pictures of us standing underneath some large transformers and whatnot.
I'm really weird. I would love family photos like that. Never mind. Moving right along.
Well, you probably have some in front of nuclear power plants.
Not family photos, because, you know, the kids are too young to get badges to get in. But never mind.
Okay.
But in terms of the discussion in the market, in the media, it's all about generation and mm-hmm. consumption. There's some talk on the edge, you know, the fringe, those wackos like you guys and me who say, no, what about the grid?
Well, every once in a while there's talk about the grid, like when it collapses.
And then 10 minutes, and then like goldfish, 10 minutes later you forget about it.
Well, once the power comes back on, we forget about it.
Exactly. So the grid is a critical piece because it's going to determine: are we going to go to a decentralized energy model? Are we, you know, how much renewable energy can truly be produced and put on the grid? I mean, if it's going to be localized, consumed locally, that doesn't matter. You don't need to put it on the grid. So those are very important discussions that really need to be sorted out at the federal level in terms of goals, you know, objectives. Now, how much do we want to achieve and how do we get there?
Now, that's an interesting dichotomy, because one of the things that you mentioned earlier in the discussion is how you can the wind is always blowing somewhere, or it's always daylight somewhere, or there's always, something. But if you want local power, I mean, windless areas can certainly spread over several states, and certainly darkness spreads over whole countries at a time. So how does local power work with a decentralized grid? I mean, how does renewables work with a decentralized grid?
Well, I mean, you have to match the resource to the solution to the resource. Great Lakes, Lake Wind, Montana, the Great Plains, those are phenomenal wind resources.
But nobody lives there.
I'm sorry?
Nobody lives there.
Well, if you can, again, if you can, if we had an intelligent grid that could transfer that power with minimum loss, or you move manufacturing there, heavy manufacturing, things like fertilizer plants, things like that, then you utilize that. South solar. I mean, you have to match the resource to the region.
When the solar maps talk about the best areas for solar, and they obviously is heavily concentrated in the Southwest, they're still only talking 6 to 7 hours of sunlight a day. That's for the best areas.
Right, but it's usually at peak load. That sun is shining it during peak load.
Well, it's peak load if your demand is residential air conditioners, but if you're talking about moving industrial power or industrial demand, industry likes to run 24/7 because that way they make the best use of their capital assets.
Of course, and you're certainly not going to run heavy manufacturing off of photovoltaics.
Or wind. What's the average capacity factor of a wind farm?
It's current technology is between 25% and 30%.
Yep.
On average. The question is, what's the right mix? What is the next president will have an energy policy that will be far more ambitious than anything ever passed. I believe that, or attempted. I do believe that. And so how can we best influence that so that it is comprehensive, that it is strategic? You know, it's going to have nuclear. Obama's been very coy about it, but he's been open that it's going to be nuclear. So is that 5 plants? Is it 50? What's McCain at? How many does he want to do out the gate?
He says 45
and then 100. 100. Yeah, 45 and then 100. 100 total.
Interesting number.
How do you guys feel about McCain's energy nuclear plans? Are they ambitious enough, or is 100 too many? What do you guys believe the energy mix should look like in 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, I don't necessarily object to his numbers. I just don't think they're achievable on the global market. You know, all that stuff has to come from somewhere. There's a bottleneck in the pipeline when you're talking about the heavy metal components, the reactors, the steam generators, if you're doing EWRs and stuff like that. You can't just order 40 of them and have them delivered next week.
No, right. Of course not.
If you're building large PWRs and you assume that we're not going to change our industrial capacity, I agree with what Kelly just said. But I also look back to a time when between 1965 and 1990, the U.S. built 104 plants and halfway built another 100 plants and then canceled those projects. And at that time, we were designing things with slide rules and T-squares.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned some T-squares because there are some other differences that actually work against us duplicating that effort again. For example, when they were building then, because of the status of the industry and what they were trying to produce, they were learning as they went along. They were designing as they went along. They were still designing while construction was in progress. And we've learned a lot since then. The codes have come a long way. The standards have come a long way. So, for example, one plant that's near and dear to my heart that got their large heavy metal components from Rotterdam, for example, overseas and then shipped it over, and that's all wonderful and good. The plant that they got their components from, A, no longer exists, B, never did meet ASME standards because there was no ASME standard in existence at the time. So, like, if you were going to restart up that plant, you wouldn't be able to just go back and redo what they did then, because there's so much more that has to be proven, inspected, in order for them to get their end stamps and be able to produce the same products that they produced then. Because
so,
the standards come up as
so,
well.
So if the next president is strongly pro-nuclear, doesn't matter which one, but he says, we are going to have X number of plants live, and we are going to simplify regulation, we are going to streamline the approval process, I want 10 plants built. How quickly could they be built?
It's a streamlined...
With strong leadership.
Yeah, and it's got to be strong leadership, because nobody wants to lower the quality of the plants that they put in place.
That of course not.
Nobody is asking for that. And you have to balance that when you're asking for that, because when you're asking for speed and no reduction in quality, you know, you can have it fast, quick.
Well, but the crux of my question is the first 104 plants took a very long time to build each one. Now we're smarter.
No, that's not true.
So long as you think.
We had some plants that were up and running in 4 years. From the time they started.
And that could be done again.
Could you go to two?
But you can't do that for 40 plants. You could do that for 10.
Just curious. Okay.
Can we go to 2 years for construction?
Yeah.
Not with light water reactors.
No. Uh-uh.
There's a company, though, that is talking about building 4,000 nuclear power plants.
They got to be little ones.
They are little ones. They're talking about 4,000 plants that produce 70 megawatts of thermal energy each.
What's their name?
Hyperion.
Okay.
And there's another small company that's talking about building plants that produce 45 megawatt electric light water reactors that can be produced without going to Japan Steelworks, because they don't use as big a pressure vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So that company is called NuScale.
I knew, that's who it was. I've heard that name. I've been looking into some of this.
Yeah, NuScale is a very interesting project. But there are other, for example, one thing that people repeat, which is not true, which is the U.S. has not built a nuclear power plant in 30 years. Well, we have several nuclear power plants that have been built in the last 10 years.
Yeah, they just happen to be on water and underwater.
Correct.
And Rod, that is one of the reasons I would be in favor of nationalizing baseload and nationalizing essentially, you guys probably would find it heretical, but the Navy, I would trust them all day long to operate and manage and maintain nuclear power plants more than the private sector.
Well, if you trust the Navy, what you're trusting is the people. And Kelly can back me up on this. A fair number of the influential people in the commercial nuclear power field receive their training and in some cases worked a full career in the Navy before they transitioned.
Yeah, that is assumed. But there's a difference. If you look at the sense of mission or the sense of profit. See, profit never confused you when you were on duty, did it?
No, but mission sometimes did.
It certainly could be confusing, but you were never tempted to maximize profit and minimize at the expense of something else. And so, go ahead.
One of the big advantages that sort of it's not a clear answer for that, but it's kind of an underlying theme answer for that concern, is when a nuke station is essentially locally operated, when the people that you have work there also live there, then they're protecting their own backyard when they're interested in quality and when they're interested in doing the right things the right way. And the reason why I bring that up is because I've seen a difference in tenor between local politics and federal politics. And when you talk about nationalizing something, the danger is that you lose the benefit of that local politics. You know, the people that are working here are us. They are my friends and neighbors. They are people that I trust. They're people that I run into at the grocery store. And in some of the discussions that I've heard for a national proposal when they're trying to solve the nuclear waste storage issue, for example, when they just want to federalize all the waste storage areas and then have this national answer at 100 different sites for waste storage or 60 sites, whatever it turns out to be, then the people that are there are feds, and they don't treat the local governments who live there, work there, and have a long-term interest to the community at heart. They don't treat them with respect, and you end up with this mutual distrust of each other. The locals don't like the feds being in their backyard and not talking to them, and the feds don't think the locals, they're all just yokels, they don't know what they're talking about. A lot of that's not true on both sides, but it breaks down the communication and the spirit of working together to solve, you know, issues that belong to everybody.
Well, yeah, I agree. You raise a good point, and I was simply saying that the Navy has an impeccable record of nuclear operations. That and many people in the private sector came from there, of course, but and we will never. I doubt this country is ever going to nationalize the nuclear baseload. But
who would have thought we would nationalize banks? You know what the heck. Anyway, that's another story.
Well, but the point is that discussion has been broached. It's, you know, so no, it doesn't make us the Soviet Union. I think that there are some issues where we should nationalize certain assets. That's not the topic of this discussion.
Yeah, I want to cycle back around just a little bit because this is an area where there's been a lot of discussion, and I remember having these discussions when I was on board submarines, where people would say, "Well, those commercial guys are just looking at profit." I think that people don't quite recognize how unprofitable it is to cut corners on a asset that would cost you billions of dollars to replace. The idea that the nuclear industry has anybody that it would take a shortcut to maximize, you know, today's profit at the risk of a $5 billion asset is kind of, you know.
How much are the NuScale, roughly, right? How much are those 45 megawatts, 70 megawatts? How much are those going to cost? 10 million? 20 million?
No, about 50 million.
50 million, I mean.
NuScale. 50, so, well, probably 50 to 100 million.
Yeah, so,
about $2,000 a megawatt. So
yeah.
About $100 million. That's a lot of money.
I have long ago stopped underestimating the stupidity of some Americans, and I don't mean to sound cynical, but I, you know, there's a reason that there is oversight, that there is strict regulation, safety regulations. You know, those things have to, you know, we got to balance that.
No, I recognize that, and having been around the nuclear enterprise for a very long time, I can tell you that it's probably the most conservative, and I'm not talking about politically conservative, I'm talking about just doing things by the book, very carefully, watching, being expecting the regulators to watch over you and make sure that things are done right. I can't think of any industry that is more careful about the way they do things.
Well, any petrochem plant anywhere where a slip up or an oversight is going to result in your likely extinction, your death. So, yeah, I agree with you. You know, they are very careful.
I have friends that got set up with nuclear and all the regulation and all the dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and they said as soon as they had an opportunity to get out, they would never work nuclear again. And they went to work, you know, in the chemical industry for about 2 years and came screaming back into nuclear and said they would never work in any other industry again because of the difference in standards. There's a lot of advantage that comes to the conservatism of dotting the I's and crossing the T's and making sure that you know, you've got all the other stuff done. I have another question for you, though, George. Have, by any chance, for my own curiosity, are you somewhere in your past, were you Navy nuclear by any chance?
I was Air Force nuclear. I served on the launch crew of a Titan II ICBM, 82 to 85.
Okay, that's pretty close. The reason why I asked is because I do not have any background in Navy nuclear. So when I hear you say, without understanding your background or where you're bringing the information from, when I hear you say that Navy nuclear has an outstanding safety record, the question that comes to my mind is, how would I verify that? Since the Navy nuclear does not have any public disclosure regulation policy, if they didn't have an outstanding safety record, I personally would have no way of knowing.
Outside of a serious event, you're right.
Right, which is an interesting contrast with commercial nuclear, where it's easy to say, oh, they have a terrible safety record, but in the meantime, they also have a 100% disclosure policy. So you can find out all the problems that are there, which is not true, for example, of coal industry or chemical industry or so many other industries that nuclear never gets compared to because there's no equal footing for comparison. You don't have the same public disclosure requirements in all these other industries. So it's easy to paint nuclear with an ugly brush because they're required to air all of their dirty laundry, every bit of it.
We are phenomenal fans of transparency, and that was one of the huge benefits of Energize America. Every comment, I mean, everything is out in the open, and we just don't see the downside of that. If it's a national security issue, fine. But, you know, having served in the Air Force on launch crew, knowing, just as in the nuclear Navy, how careful, how process-bound, how conservative, how professional those men and women were, you know, other than some yo-yos letting B-52s fly around with some nuclear-armed cruise missiles 2 years ago, I don't know how the hell that ever happened, but, you know, the military, by and large, has had a phenomenal record. They've lost a few bombs, I guess, off of Georgia or something, but and the one, I think it was the Thrasher, but that was not a nuclear accident. It's a nuclear vessel, but it was not a nuclear accident. So
right. But Kelly's point is well taken. The nuclear industry is required by law to air its dirty laundry.
And it should.
But the thing is that it's hard for people who don't know much to balance the difference between a spill of slightly radioactive material that doesn't have any impact at all on the environment or on health or anything, and, you know, routine leakages, routine emissions that come out of other types of energy production facilities. I mean, you know, it's just that's the challenge, is to understand what all of those disclosures mean. The explanation, the communication that says, hey, by the way, we have had hundreds of, quote, near misses, but that's like saying every day driving down the highway, every second there's near misses, but they're not collisions. You know, nothing happened. Nobody got hurt.
Well,
nobody got sick.
And you learn from them just as the FAA does at air traffic control near miss. I mean, there's a process in place to document and to minimize risk.
Right.
So I agree with you.
Well, you know, this has been a – go ahead, Kelly. I'll let you go one more time, but then we're going to start wrapping up.
Here's my last question. George, where can we find the 20 points in the Energize America plan?
Oh, EA2020.org. I'm sorry. I should have said that out front.
That's all right. Thank you much.
My pleasure.
That was going to be part of what we do in the sign-off. George, is there any other websites or things that you want to point to where people can find out more about your current plans or your future plans?
Well, the current streamlined version of Energize America focused on the Energy Smart Communities Act, greening the schools, plug-in hybrid electric buses, energy, green energy education, and electrified rail and electrified mail. Those are on the Energize America website, and the most mature of those is the Energy Smart Communities Act, which, if you're familiar with the Vote Solar Initiative out of San Francisco, is a public-private bond program whereby you're investing in energy efficiency and or a mix of renewable energy, and you're paying for the bond with the savings from your efficiency program or the new money revenue, new revenues from your renewable energy. So energy efficiency typically is, pays for these things. And so it's a way to, as I talked about earlier, we need to change our DNA. We need to change how the average American, the average citizen, the average student thinks about energy. When my 10-year-old daughter looks at a large flag waving in the breeze, she says, "Dad, look at the money in that flag." That is what I'm talking about. That's somebody who, that is a different paradigm of understanding, and that's just one little example. So the Energy Smart Communities Act is a program that goes into every congressional district and is intended to drive this awareness, this change, these examples down to the community level. We are only going to win this battle for energy independence at the community level. It has got to be demanded by the citizens.
I agree with you, and I also agree with Kelly that the more remote the control is, the less you're going to have success in that area. It's got to be people close to the problem who are going to solve it.
Well, but some of those things cannot be solved locally. No one's locally going to solve the grid.
Well, quite honestly, there is no technical reason why we need to be connected electrically.
In a truly decentralized fashion.
Over a large area.
Fair enough.
I don't know. For reliability and defense and depth, it just goes against the grain not to be.
Well, but you can have a reliable defense and depth grid over a small area with a number of reliable generators in a small area. Or on a ship, for example.
I've spent a career in the internet industry. I see a very clear parallel to the electrical grid as I do to an IP network. It can be resilient. It can, it can be essentially fail-proof. It can be made fail-proof. It can be, you can have decentralized information sources. So, my background is in tech after I got out of the Air Force. So, I do believe there are ways to solve that. That's a conversation for another time, and I have really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope that we can use your input and your audience's input to make sure that the next president's energy policy is comprehensive, is strategic, and is achievable.
Well, I think that we will definitely keep in touch, and as you get ready to build your next version, I may bring in some of my friends who are bloggers on Daily Kos these days, N. Nadir and Dave Walters, and we'll help.
Now, one question I do have for you real quick before you go. Nuclear power right now is 20% of our mix. What should it be?
Of our electricity?
Yeah.
80%.
And what would you have the other 20% be?
Oh, hydro, a little bit of natural gas maybe, and wind and solar where it makes sense.
So you'd go to zero coal if you could?
Oh, absolutely. Burning coal for electricity is not a good use of the resource.
It's so last century is how I think about it.
Well, it's actually more like 18th century.
Fair enough. well,
I'm sorry, 19th century.
Yes, yes, yes.
The 1800s.
Yes, exactly. Rod and Kelly, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about Energize America, and I look forward to communicating with you both in the future.
George, it's been a treat. I actually didn't take any offense with a housewife comment because I'm not a housewife. I just aspire to be one. I just haven't gotten good enough to get there yet.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
There's a way is such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.